Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We do for you in ITY.
Cool.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now,
now we're time to do the right, right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Right now.
That's right, that's right. We are going to do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are here live at Black Radio Hall of Fame. You know, when I say that we're going to do it right, there's so many people trying to do it wrong and make sure we don't do it right that we got to be more strategic. We got to be more serious, y'all, in 2024. But this is the show that brings together folks who are on the battlefield, and they are on various battlefields. They are fighting for health care. They're fighting for workers' rights. They're fighting for housing and for the unhoused. And so, you know, a lot of times we don't see how those battlefields connect until we hear people talk about it. And so I've just been very honored to be able to bring folks here on the show so that you could hear them, so you could hear their struggles, whether it be in St. Louis or other parts of the country. But we sometimes feel like we're isolated, especially in the heartland, like nothing's going on here, you know, nobody's doing anything. But people are struggling in the Midwest, and they are, you know, making some victories, making some gains. So we want to be as positive as we can, but still be realistic about what we still need to do. So we have two guests that definitely have been on the battlefield for a while. I'm not going to say how long, but one of them is a return guest. If you remember, Baba Tu Murphy came to us to talk about blacks in the Catholic Church. So he's back with us. This time he's coming with, you know, accolades and awards from, Educator of the Year from the St. Louis Excellence Award, 55 years of teaching in public schools. He needs to have something else. Wish we could send him to Jamaica somewhere. Baba Tu is here with us again, and he's coming with, you know, all kinds of background in terms of what he's done. And, you know, all these two brothers are my co-conspirators. They're my brothers in struggle. We've been doing this for a very long time together. Our other guest is Kalimu Ndesha, and he's the heartbeat of the Infrared Rockers. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about that, because this is a session really about the Organization for Black Struggle, of which all three of us are founding members. And this is the 44th anniversary of the Organization for Black Struggle. So we're just going to have a conversation about how we came to found that organization. And I would say, first of all, welcome to Voices from the Battlefield.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Debo, thank you. I'm glad to be here. Well.
Yeah. So one of the things I have to say is, before there was a OBS, there was a Congress of African People. There was a People Fighting Repression. There were a number of predecessor organizations that we helped to put together that really did lead to an intentional founding of an organization like OBS. So I want to start with the Congress of African People, because that's where we all first met. 70, somewhere up in there?
72, I believe.
It was before 72, because I came here in 71, and we had already started talking about what we were going to do in terms of a chapter. So I'm going to start with one thing that is non-refutable, and that is, we decided that we were going to go to Newark, New Jersey, which is where the headquarters, the national headquarters, was for the Congress of African People, because we were set really to relocate and be part of that fantastic organized institution up that way. And what were we told by Amira Baraka and Amina Baraka when we said, we are here, we want to stay, we want to build something with you all? What did they tell us?
I'm pretty sure they told us to go back home and do something and build where you are, because I know how both of them don't play when it comes to you know, speaking truth and really encouraging people to take a look at their own situation back home.
That's exactly what they told us.
Now, my understanding was a little bit different in the sense that they were one of the many organizations that we visited throughout the country, because we were looking for the right model to bring back to St. Louis. Because our thing was, we came together, and we were doing work around African Free School. We were doing cultural work and stuff like that. And finally, we said, "But we need an organization." And the question was, "What kind of organization we need?" And so we said we needed more than what was already in St. Louis. So we went all over the country, including Chicago and, you know, different places like that. But we went to Newark, New Jersey. That was the place where we said everything was just right there, everything we needed, you know, in terms of putting together an organization. It was just there. And so we said, okay, this is what we are going to go back to St. Louis with. So that, I remember more so like that.
Okay, I don't think it's much different. There's some nuance there, but I think, we probably did go all over, but I think because the visit to Newark had such a compelling impact on me, that's what I remember most. Because as you said, it had all the components that we were looking for. They had a cultural component, they had a political organizing component, they had an economic development component, and all of that I think really, made sense to us in terms of what we needed to do. But the other thing they told us is to build institutions. And I think that, you know, for me, and we've talked about this many times over the years, that's what we remembered and that's what we felt like we were supposed to do, to create institutions. And so, you know, right away we set up, at that point it was not the Rowan Community Center, it was the Heykalu. And, you know, we were very young, but we put together some pennies and bought that building. And it's an institution now that's been standing ever since. So when I think about institution building, I feel like that's where we cut our teeth, is like with the Congress of African People. So from out of that came the cultural piece, which, you know, for you all initially was Proletariat Ensemble, then it moved to Infrared Funk, and then it moved to Infrared Rockers. But you were always on the cutting edge of the music, of the political landscape. So talk about even that piece of it, like what it meant to take the cultural component of organizing. And as we know, Amiri Baraka was the premier person who believed that, you know, arts, black arts in particular, was a cultural weapon in our struggle for liberation. So what was the thinking behind moving that, and how it changed over time with the times?
I remember there were three organizations, three groups. There was Uhura Ensemble, there was the drummers, the Omawali Dance and Drum Troupe, and there was Progressive Emporium. I'm pretty sure they might have had a slightly different name, but they were, it wasn't Progressive Emporium yet. It was, they were performers. They were actors.
Malika and...
No, it was still Kudaliwa and them, but they had a different name. They were, you remember that name?
Look, it don't come to mind. It's right there at the tip of my tongue.
But my point is, they were, I'm going to say, actors, actresses, that type of thing. So you had the theater component, you had the dance and drum ensemble, and you had the band. And so those three basic entities started to come together and you know, basically work on things. And I want to say the big thing I remember is the growth and development and support of Black consciousness. For me, that had already, it really started even when I was still back in college. I was in a religious organization, and that's where the whole Catholic thing comes in. And all over the planet, I'm going to say, there was this recognition, rebirth of the African diaspora and what our indigenous cultures mean to us. And so that thread is I remember what was kind of guiding me. Even in Uhura Ensemble, which was a family band, we were still looking at, you know, our culture and what it meant and what that message is. But that's what I remember. So this is a good session to have, folks.
so your recollection and particularly the impact it had on you, Kalimu, in terms of the cultural arts piece being a motivating factor to really looking at the world that we live in, was that also not the case for you?
Well, most definitely it was, because for me now, I became a part of the Umuali Dance and Drum Ensemble. And this is after I had just got out of prison. You know, while in prison, I was able to do a lot of study in terms of different Black leaders and stuff, Mary Baraka.
And tell us why you were in prison, because I think that's important.
I was in there because I refused to go to Vietnam, and they said, well, you don't want to cut your beard off, you don't want to be fingerprinted, because you say you're Black nationalist, so that there's no such religion, we are locking you up. So we were facing, I was facing like 10 years in prison. I ended up doing 1 year in prison. But while I was there, me and Johari, one of the founding members of Infrared Rockers, you know, and who later, you know, Mary, who's, et cetera, she was keeping me informed about everything that was going on outside. So I knew that once I got out of prison, I wanted to be a part of an organization. I wanted to start one. And so, but she was already part of the Omawali Dance and Drum Ensemble. And so then I started going to those sessions, and then I started playing congas, learning how to play the bass part. And so all along, my thing was, well, what can we do with this group? Because she had also been a part of the Black auditor group. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, very political, it's trying to serve the community. And so my thing, too, was like, how can we do the same thing with the Omawali Dance and Drama Ensemble? But it didn't quite work that way, but that is like that group. Everybody in there was not forming an organization, so we did what we could do with that, but we moved on to form our own African dance and drama, something called Taifa Drummers and Dancers, which you were a part of, Jamala.
That's what it was.
At that time. You know, and let me just add this part. But we also really hooked up with Kutluwazinam group. I forget their name, because we all used to all rehearse in the same building, Mid-City.
Mid-City.
Down on Delmo, we all rehearsed in that same building. But we had what I remember to be the very first citywide Kwanzaa celebration. We all came together and we performed and what have you at that particular session. And from there we said, well, we need to do more than just this. Let's do some more stuff like this. And so that laid the roots for us forming what would become Working Always Through Unity. That was the first organization we had called WATU. And it was based on the principles of the Nguzo Saba and African Free School and culture and a lot of other things that fighting against police brutality, those kind of things, were some of the things that we began to take up.
And I, you know, when we think about some of the predecessor organizations to the Organization for Black Struggle, I think because we were involved in those, whether it be prison or police violence, that we were able to really hit the ground running with OBS, because we already had had experience in particularly those two sectors, because we were working with, you know, brothers in prison since the 70s. We had People Fighting Repression, which was around police violence. That was in the 70s. All of those groups, we also had the one around people struggling against prisons, which was the Missouri Nine. Our feet were deeply planted in those particular areas. So it wasn't a big leap when we came, when we founded the Organization for Black Struggle, to say those gotta be some of the cornerstones of the work that we're doing. And the other piece that I remember pretty vividly was workers' rights, because we felt like when we started thinking about what kind of organization that we wanted, we also looked around, because I think one of the things that I'm proud of is, like, even though we were young, we were not like rash or spontaneous. We're like, let's look around and see what's here. And we were looking at different organizations, and we said, well, we don't see one that's really advocating and organizing working class people. We got the Urban League, and it's, you know, providing services, but who's organizing black folks, black workers? And we said, we want that kind of organization. And that's a big piece of our mission. And the other piece was youth and education. And that continues to be a cornerstone. And so I think having worked in those areas before OBS was officially founded really was a catalyst for what we were to become.
Let me add this. And I think what was really key was the fact that, see, the Congress of African People, it was a national organization, and it was made up of cadre organizations. And that is, like, you know, in every city, we had a core of members who were organized around a particular ideology of black liberation, you know, and in Guzo Saba, and we all learned the same organizing principles. And we also, the Congress of African People had ties with the progressive African countries and all of the liberation movements and stuff too. So therein lie the roots of the seeds for, like, the African Liberation Day, us being a part of that and having a chapter, all those things. A lot of it came out of CAP, the Congress of African People, because also Richard Dockett, one of the founding members of OBS, he contacted the Congress of African People. He said, hey, look, I'm catching hell over here at General Motors, you know. Are these racists, you know, they're dogging us out. I need help. The national office put us in touch. And so we started doing work over there at General Motors, fighting against the discrimination and racism over there with all those workers and starting to organize them. So that was our first step as far as really getting our feet wet and going on and getting involved with a whole lot of different workers' struggles, especially black workers' struggles, at that time, you know. So like, but the Congress of African People, it provided that kind of umbrella that we needed, that had that kind of national view. Say, okay, there are people contacting you, they need to know about this and that, check it out. And we would always get on top of that, and we always had the national office to get guidance from. That was always so key, because it also had what was called the School of Kawaita. Go there, you can learn community organizing, electoral politics, you know, youth work, coalition building, United Front, all that stuff. So that was what was so powerful about being a part of the Congress of African People.
And that reminds me about, first of all, the National Black Political Convention that happened in Gary, Indiana, yes, where the Congress of African People were actually the infrastructure that helped organize 50,000 people to come to Gary. I'm sorry, 10,000. It was 50,000 that went to African Liberation Day in D.C. But and then continue to organize, you know, assemblies after that. But I'm just thinking about the power of a national infrastructure, which I don't, we don't really have now. We don't have a black, you know, politically left, you know, organizations that's helping to give guidance to the local organizing on the ground. And I think we feel it, we see it when we see what's going on in our communities. But the other thing I thought about is there would not be the Kwanzaa that we know today had it not been for the you know, Congress of African People. Because although it was, you know, Dr. Maulana Karanga's idea, he was also part of the Congress of African People then. He was in the L.A. chapter. There was no way for L.A. to completely politicize and socialize and propagate that idea without us having chapters across the country. And so for us in St. Louis, being one of the first to do Kwanzaa, we know that we did it with the slings and arrows of even our own people to say, what are y'all doing? Y'all trying to mess up Christmas. Like, this is not about Christmas. And what we said is, like, basically we practicing self-determination. This is what we do, and this is what we're going to do, and we don't care who thinks something is wrong about it, particularly white people. But, and so here we are today in, you know, 2024, and now, you know, Kwanzaa, you know, is almost, you know, I won't say it's fully mainstream, but it's fairly mainstream. Anytime it appears on your utilities bill is, you know, happy Kwanzaa, happy Hanukkah, and happy Christmas. You know, it's mainstream. But had it not been for the Congress of African People, and I think even Dr. Karanga would probably admit that as well, that there would be, folks would even know that there would be a such a thing as Kwanzaa. So yeah, I think, you know, the grounding was there for many things to happen. And sometimes, you know, in spaces, people weren't able to make it happen like other folks were. I think in St. Louis, we had a good core of people who were committed and understood the local conditions and to continue to organize. And so, when we looked at probably during the 70s, and this is even in some of our documents, it's like there was, you know, we had the attack on the Black Liberation Movement, on the Panthers, and you know, people were either dead, exiled, or in prison. And there was just this void, and we kept saying, what? We gotta fill that void. We gotta do something. And that is, the basis in which the Organization for Black Struggle was founded.
I really, appreciated, appreciating this historical perspective, because, the thing about the Congress of African People, I'll never forget the first chant slogan I learned was, "The people united will never be defeated." And I remember being in Newark at Amir Baraka's wake, and as Amina was leaving, that was the chant that she brought up: "The people united will never be defeated." The other beautiful thing is that, like you say, with the Congress of African People, there was that national and international connection, which, even like when I started this whole thing about Africans in the diaspora and what's happening with us and to us, I remember so many things that were inspiring, you know, from Amina and Amiri, and like with Amina, and then through her, Johari, you know, I remember my first experiences with dealing with respect for Black women. You know, there was a lot of things, and all these different themes are still with us in good old white supremacist, male-dominated capitalist America right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that organization side that connects us, even with the struggles in Grenada. All kinds of things, you know. What was it? Studying modes of production and not being afraid to talk about, you know, capitalism, socialism, communism, and getting that type of perspective. These are the types of things that I'm saying connected the whatever it was in all our histories that we grew up with, being conscious of what's happening to our people
right
and
now.
What's happening, it just made that connection move forward.
And let me add to that, and that is like the beauty of the Congress of African People was the fact that we just did not focus on one area. Because our thing was, you know, ideology back at that time was nationalism, Pan-Africanism, and scientific socialism.
Yes.
And so therefore, and I'm just adding on what you're saying, that gave us a real broad view. And so a lot of the other organizations in the Black Liberation Movement, they were dealing with certain aspects of the movement, certain parts of it, whereas we dealt with all those different aspects. And so we were always able to work with all of the groups, because our thing was the Black Liberation Movement is made up of many different organizations in all of the classes, working class, middle class, that's fighting for our liberation. And so you have to figure out a way to bring them all together and stuff. That means you got to work with them and find some principles that allow you to do that. And so therefore, we formed what was called, we had the African Women's Conference, out of which came the Black Women's United Front. We formed the chapter of the African Liberation Support Committee. And of course, we mentioned like National Assembly. We had a Missouri Assembly. There was a lot of Stop Killer Cops campaign, out of which came finally Cap Corps. You know, and I can just go on and on. It was based on the fact that we understood that these are all of the parts of the liberation struggle. It's not just voting. It's not just protesting. It's you have to have an organization that has that holistic of view that put together as much of it as possible and realistically do what you can and build upon that, because and it's going to still take all of us. Everybody's willing to fight to overthrow this racist system and end oppression, and that's the only way we're going to get our liberation, our self-determination.
And I'm thinking, though, because I always go back to how old we are at that point and what we were exposed to, and the fact that it's hard to replicate something like that for future organizers. And I think for many Gen Zs that, you know, the context, the ecosystem in which they came into politicization, it's not the same. And for a lot of who knew about what happened in the 60s, they like, what y'all did back then? But that was then and this is now. And so it's a completely different conditions, which, you know, to the point that you were talking about, Kalimu, there was a political analysis that was a collective political analysis. It wasn't like, oh, Jamala thinks this is what's going on, so therefore she's going to do this. It was collective, and we felt like we had a lot of voices and people from different strata that was helping to formulate that, so it just wasn't a small, like, little thinking. But the other thing I often, like, would share with young people is, you know, this whole thing about young people don't listen to their elders, that wasn't true. We absolutely were listening to our elders, because we were just babes, just kids, and folks would say, this is what y'all need, our elders, this is what y'all need to do. And we pretty much did it, because it looked like they had faith in us. And I remember when I was writing Ferguson is America, Roots of Rebellion, and I talked about when we went to Castle Point, when adult people were getting crosses on their lawns and didn't know what to do, they called us. And I think about that all the time. I'm like, we were just kids. But they were so frustrated, they didn't know what to do. They're desperate that they would be willing to call some young people that looked like they were fearless, which we were, to come out there and help organize with them. And we did. And so that's why I always have such profound love for young people, because without them, the spirit, the creativity, the imagination, is going to be missing. And so that's why everywhere around the world there are intergenerational liberation struggles. It's not old people doing it. It's not all young people. It's intergenerational, because you have to draw from all of the strengths and assets that all the strata have, all the classes have, all the ages have. And we seem to have gotten confused about that in this country, because individualism is now the name of the game. You're so smart, Baba Too, you're an influencer. You have X number of people following you on social, and you ain't done a damn thing but talk. So I'm just the paradigm has shifted, as my friend would say. The paradigm has shifted, and now it's not the collective that's moving our struggles, but it's individual people who are popular on Facebook. So I'm always humbled by the fact that we listened to the people who were older than us, who saw in us potential, saw in us leadership, and helped to develop that.
And see, now we're the older people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the good things is there are young people who are listening to us, who are watching us, who believe in us. And who are willing to keep fighting for the things that they see we've done. And the other big thing through all of this is the Nguzo Saba, a value system. I remember one time you reminded me, one of the things that Amiri always talked about. You when you're gonna have a movement, you have to have a value system. And that is the key. And I'm telling you, one of the most exhilarating things that I saw in the school district was when two black young people came and performed the whole concept of the Nguzo Saba. And to see other young black folks, the students who were watching them, get it. And that between that and then this whole issue of quote unquote rap, which originally was hip hop, even in hip hop, the original side of it was about fighting to bring people together to fight for democracy. Like you say, wherever somebody's making decisions about us, but we ain't there, we gotta be there. And the young people get it, but there aren't enough of us leading them to an organization and getting them to organize to actually fight. And that's what we keep hearing. Remember, we always are organize, organize, organize. We hear it in the union meetings and so forth. So I'm just saying, there were so many people over the years that kept reminding mm-hmm. us of why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are reminding mm-hmm. other folks, and again, we're back documentaries, books,
they summations of what,
these books.
That's
right. Some summarizing what all you went through and what brought you to mm-hmm. the way you think now.
Mm-hmm. And why are you still here?
Yes.
So, the other, just if you're joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And I'm here in a conversation with Baba Too, Charles Murphy, and Kalimu Indesha. We are founding members of the Organization for Black Struggle. And we're talking a lot about the predecessor organizations that helped groom us to even found such an organization that exists some 44 years later. So, we're talking about the responsibility that was put on us by our elders, and I think we rose to the occasion, because sometimes when we look back, we say, wow, we didn't know we could do that. Or we didn't even have fear that that was a dangerous situation. And that, you know, but our elders already had seen what we could do. And, that's the only reason they placed us in those positions of leadership. So I think you're right, Baba, too. We have to look at the folks around us and see and tap into their potential, tap into their leadership to say, hey, I think you got something there. And, you know, not sort of broad brush, you know, a whole generation and say, you know, they just a bunch of whiny babies that just about themselves, when that is absolutely not true, because there were things negatively said about our generation. And and you know, that's not to say that everybody in our generation was on the up and up and involved, because they weren't. And I always tell young people who believe that, you know, everything in the 60s, all the black folks was involved, I said, if all the black folks was involved in the struggle in the 60s, we'd be liberated. So no, everybody was not involved. So let's just keep it real. So Kelly, it seems like you wanted to join in.
Let me grab my thought back. The one thing I want to say, what we don't have, I mean, and going back to the fact that, see, with CAP, we had this national organization and presence that people could look to, and they could come there or have folks come to their city if they wanted to start a chapter, if they had a struggle. That's something we don't have. We tried that with the National Black Assembly. We tried that with the African Liberations Committee. We tried that with the Black Radical Congress.
And with the National Black United Front.
Right, yeah. And the National Black United Front. And then, like, most recently, they're trying it with, like, the Black Lives Matter movement. But to me, that kind of organization where you have a core of committed people, that is, and they're not dependent upon being paid by some nonprofit foundation, but they have another means of income, which what was unique about CAP, because CAP was not getting money from foundations and things, but it had what was called Jamaa, all these means of self-reliance and stuff, selling different books and tapes and
clothing,
artifacts,
every
kind of way that you bring in income. That was what was going on, and that made the organization self-reliant. And that way you could really build the kind of organization you need, as opposed to somebody saying, well, look, as people say all the time, hey, look, I gotta pay my bills, and so I don't have time for y'all, you know, and I still think that's what I would say is like ghetto volunteerism, because for us, our struggle, our people, we're here because of what we went through the middle passages, all of those of us that died, the millions of us that died, the thousands of us that died on the plantation, got tortured all the different kind of ways. Our blood of survival is still there. And we didn't get paid to still keep on fighting for our freedom, you know, in spite of being lynched, you know, and all those other horrors that we suffered. We didn't get paid for that, you know, because freedom ain't free at the same time. But you can't say, well, look, I got to pay my bills, so I can't fight for freedom until I get my bills paid for, because they go hand in hand. Do you understand why you can't pay your bills? Because
right.
You are oppressed. Exactly. You are exploited. You know? So therefore, if we all come together and realize, as you say, individualism, no, it's the collective of we that's all been oppressed. And so we got to come together and figure out how we're going to have organizations of struggle, of forced struggle, of people who are committed to giving X amount of their time, because, hey, look, everybody gives time, whether it's the church or the social club or to whatever thing they give time to, they give serious time. That same kind of stuff got to be given to the organization without any question. It can't be like, well, I'm not getting paid, you know, kind of thing. If you can get paid, that's fine, but the organization, don't expect the organization to pay you, because all of us need to pay our bills and stuff. So we have to figure out another way to deal with that. But the main thing is that we don't have that kind of structure. We can bring people in and train them. All this knowledge that we have right now, we're sitting here talking. As I was coming down here, I was saying, you know what? We probably need a podcast, because all of the stuff we're talking about, we give you people the short version of it. There's quite a bit to it. that folks really need to be able to check out so they can see like it was a process that brought us where we are, but it's a rich history that you can dig into and pull out of the best stuff. And that stuff, you say, oh, this is a little bit different. Tweak that and that over there, and then we can move this thing forward. But ain't that what our press do? They figure out, well, they evaded this here trick. Here's, we're going to trick that trick, and we're going to come with this one over here.
We're going to come with a better mousetrap.
Yep, mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah. So, one of the, you know, when you made me think about the fact that there are people who, it's not that they're ahistorical or apolitical. It's like this stuff does not get taught. And we, meaning folks like us, don't have like the broad platform that other folks do. So yeah, we got a lot of knowledge, but when I see who's out here influencing young activists, it really is this whole legion of nonprofits that are set up to help you organize. And most of them haven't ever organized. So I think it's just fascinating how this thing has flipped. And so the folks then run to them to say, okay, this consortium teaches us about organizing, but they completely step over the folks who've been organizing in their neighborhoods for like decades. And they're always people who've been organizing in their community for decades. It's like, you may not have known about it, but they've been there. And so I just think that the legitimacy that we keep giving to folks whose interest is not really about liberation, it really is about money and pretending to be progressive. But they're intermediaries that are depending on funding from, you know, corporations and that kind of thing. So it's only so much that they're going to teach you how to do. But when you start looking at, and you mentioned the whole nonprofit industrial complex, there are people who are there. That's their strata. And I don't know that we should be poo-pooing or undermining them, because folks that are what I call buffering the suffering, then that allows folks who are really about organizing people to challenge the system. Because you pointed out the reason that you losing your home, we know why. And we can organize around that, and we can help figure that out. But if you just think that that was, you know, a bad decision on your part, and then, you know, you victimize again and again by the messages in capitalist society, then there's really nowhere to go with that but to sit down and say, woe is me. And so I'm saying that all of us have a role to play. And I you know, one of the things I always try to challenge OBS not to do is, and that is to be that whole kind of, like, we need to be providing some food. And I said, there's plenty of folks out there doing that better than us that are, you know, giving out food baskets. There's nobody doing what we're doing. And so you have to, like, find your niche, and then you say, here's what we got to do, here's how we do it, and here's why we do it.
But that whole thing, like Colin said, of a podcast, that is one of the main ways to get that message out there. And between a podcast and then documentaries, that's definitely a way to get it out there. Even if you just start it and just do it, somebody else is going to, it's going to touch other people. And that's what I'm noticing, you know, if we pay attention to whose voices are not being heard, and we figure out where they are and why not, we can follow up on that. And as we, you know, have our podcast or our presentation, that will reach a lot of these other people, and things will start to connect. To me, the real key in all of this is we have to be what we expect other people around us to be. And to me, the biggest issue is autocracy versus democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been saying that for years, Because that's what I've been hearing from Amiri and everybody else. People that was teaching us about modes of production. That's the whole point, is to be able to have democracy as what is it? As simple and basic as that sounds, that is what this is all about. And we can never support or not point out autocracy for what it is and how it destroys democracy wherever it pops up.
And I would say we're moving past autocracy to authoritarianism where there's no room for democracy, room for dissent, even in some of our organizations.
Exactly. Even in our organizations, in our personal lives. Because as soon as you start listening to people talk, you start to see. Remember what we used to talk about? What was it? Criticism, self-criticism. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't go through life unresponsive to the effect that you have on other people.
Mm.
And you have to respect criticism and self-criticism. Because that's where it starts. That's where it spreads from and goes to. And people will say, oh, that's how it works.
Because
I'll tell you, all these years in that school district, I hear people on the job, wherever they are on the job, they're having the same issues on the job. You hear people talking about what's happening on the job. Oh, my goodness.
That's where they spend most of their time. So
they trying to make a living,
mm-hmm.
and what they doing, they got it. So now you can't even make a living. You can work all kind of hours, but your hours ain't worth what this other person's hours are. Who the hell decided that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man.
So, Kalima, you know, one of the things that I'd like for you to respond to is this whole notion of transformation seems to have gotten a bit abstract and empty. In the Congress of African People, there was a social, what did we call it? It was a committee whose role it was to re-socialize us as folks living in America. So Kawaida was like, you know, what's African and what's, you know, practical in America? Like, what could we actually be doing here? And it just, it
tradition
seemed,
and reason.
Yeah, tradition and reason. That's what Kawaida meant. And so part of what we were doing in CAP is re-socializing us in terms of how we got to have all these messed up ideas about ourselves, about women, about, you know, all of that. And so that to me is something that I really believe in then and now, that you can't have people who are broken, torn, however you want to say it, misinformed, misguided, and put them into a situation and think they're going to be empowering to other people. And this goes also to your point, Baba, too. It's like, there's so much going on. There's so much healing that hasn't taken place that when people say, oh, I want to be an activist, I want to be an organizer, and they're bringing in all this baggage and thinking that's, they don't need to work on themselves, they need to work on other people, to me is really missing the point. Because if we really are talking about establishing democracy where we are, based in our families, our church, our organization, then it has to start with what impact am I having negatively on this community, small or large, that I need to be working on. And we don't seem to be interested in criticism, self-criticism, constructive criticism, whatever. So when you think about transformation and the new African and the new world that we're trying to build, what is that going to look like unless we actually do more around people's individual issues that are part of the reason that they're like that is because they've been in this capitalist society and they've been told, here's how a man acts, here's how a woman acts, here's how black people are gonna get treated. You got all of those messages from birth. How are you gonna be empowered to lead anything with any degree of dignity?
Well, I think the first thing would be that in terms of OBS, that we have to bring that component back within the organization, whereby when people become a part of it, we have to understand, as you say, they bring the baggage, they bring all these certain ideas that are not necessarily compatible with what the struggle calls for. And we have to have ways that we have sessions where we get them to understand what the struggle is involved with and the values that we think they should embrace, because to me, the seven principles of blackness in Usosava, those are very valid principles.
And not just for the 7 days of Kwanzaa.
There you go. And that everybody, and that we should be showing them how those are practiced every day in our work, and that, that's a conscious thing that we do. And in that context, we're able to take a look and say, well, okay, are we practicing this principle as we try to about our work? You know, if we need have self-criticism, well, what about, is this unity? Is this what Moji been practicing?
Right.
We say, well, no, it's not. And then basically say, well, okay, but this is what we should be doing as opposed to that individualistic approach, because society definitely promotes individualism all day and all night. And so therefore, we have to all day and all night be continually like some kind of commercial.
Let
it be known.
Yes.
No, we got to be about Umoja. Once again, the approach you're talking about, that's not Umoja. This is what it is, my brother or my sister kind of thing. And in such a way that hopefully that they'll get it, that they don't think that we're putting them down. It's just the ideas that they have which come out of that practice, which is not a collective one. We have to put that part back within the structure of our internal organization, internal education of our members when they come in, get them to understand it's not enough just to do the work, but you have to understand why you're doing it and what are the principles that it represents, not just in some kind of mechanical way, but that you really realize that you instinctively, what you do is call self-determination, because it's what it is. It's collective work responsibility, because that's what it is. That's a process that takes time, but you have that kind of consistency. You have to have, once again, I'm going to say that component there, that is people whose job is to make sure that the membership continually is educated and re-educated and transformed. It's not enough to have a session. Here and there. It's got to be an ongoing kind of process. To me, I think that's lacking in OBS for starting, but then in most other organizations, from what I can see, that don't happen. They just get together and they talk about the events
the
and
work.
Whatnot, and then that's it.
Yep.
But that's not enough, because we have to have that kind of transformation you're talking about. Otherwise, we can't set that example for our young people, for our children, and we can't get the community to say, okay, yes, they are about what they say.
But I think that's why we always are intentional, even in our literature, about connecting the real world with those organizing principles. So when we talk about, for example, electoral politics, we talk about self-determination. We talk about how that's a manifestation of that if we do it right. And I know a lot of times people say, well, we're electing all these black folks and nothing is changing, but the problem is not those people. The problem is the system itself. And so once we begin to see that this system is not going to work for us, then you start really thinking about what other system could we be looking at. But if people are tied to the system, you have to show them, as we were taught in Kaida, that it's, corrupt and unworkable, and it's not going to work for us. So the tweaking that we're doing now is really on the long road to something different that's going to actually be humanly embracing for the humanity that's left here. And I say left here because some of these folks now are going to the moon and going to the seas, and they done completely contaminated Earth, and now they're trying to escape and leaving this mess for us. But I think, you know, the transformation piece for me, I always tell people when I'm traveling is, think about if we were given five states and the people that you know are going to go to those states and start a new government. What do you think is going to be the result of that? And then they both say, I'll do just what y'all just did. So that's why transformation is so important. We only have a few minutes left, y'all, and this has definitely been engaging conversation. So for us, in terms of three people who've been doing this for over 50 years, and you know, probably continue to do it until they scoop us off the floor. What do we want young people to know about the struggle?
They need to know that we can change. You can't change the past, but you can change the present and the future. We really can. There's only two kinds of problems. The ones that have been solved and the ones that haven't been solved yet. And until we believe that we have to take a step-by-step approach, and we have to point out, when there's a good example of one of the Nguzo Saba or some of them, we have to celebrate those folks. We have to support those folks the same way we support Jobs for Justice, all the different organizations. Because remember, we had learned coalitions, et cetera, et cetera. There are always a way to work together. And we need to go and start that podcast.
What's your wisdom for the folks?
Well, the main thing that only struggle brings about change. That's the only constant thing. But in order for you to have the struggle, you have to have an organization that is rooted among the people, based in the community, that takes up the people's struggles, that lead those struggles, that all this education that you're getting, that's what the people need. The people need to get the understanding that you have so that they can understand better how to fight for Black liberation. And so they have to understand that's what their mission is. It's not popular. So you don't look to your friend and say, well, my friend's not doing it. No. What is your commitment? Are you for the liberation of your people? Because then you're talking about your friends, your family, etc. So I think that's one part of what young people need to understand, that they're like, It's not a 100-yard dash. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a marathon. And look, you know, and as the saying goes, never get weary yet. Mm. We've come a long, long way. You know, but never get weary yet. It's a long way. We still got to go. But Pomoja Tutashinda, that means together we will win. And that's what we have to get them to understand, in spite of all this other negative stuff telling them, no, you know, that ain't about nothing. Just go for yourself.
Yeah. So, you know, when I think about this conversation, Baba Tu always got this saying, to be continued.
Yeah.
Yes, we need to have a part two. We really do need to have
Absolutely.
A part two. And we will, because, you know, as we are moving towards our 45th anniversary, I think there's a lot for people to learn, a lot for us to celebrate, and, you know, we do want to lift that up. So this weekend, y'all, lots of stuff is going on. In fact, tonight, you know, on the Harrisville campus at the Emerson Building Theater, there's the AFT Local 2420 is going to be having a session, a public forum on how our public schools are being deprived of tax dollars. And if you all have never heard of TIFs, I call them gifts. These, you know, corporations come in and say they're going to do X, Y, and Z, and they get all these tax abatements and then really don't provide what they need to provide in terms of the payback. So that's at 5 o'clock this evening, 5 to 7:30. So if you can make that due, I know it's a short notice. this coming Saturday, I think it is, you know, there's going to be a execution of Brian Dorsey if we don't stop it. But there's going to be a launch of the media toolkit on January 26th at noon, and it's going to be Zoom. I need to find out how to get you the Zoom link, but I would say go to Missourians to Abolish the Death Penalty to find out more, because that's who's sponsoring that. And then next Tuesday, Missouri Voter Advocates Day is at the state capitol. And here we are, you all, in 2024, still fighting for voting rights. It's sad. You know, I think Dr. Martin Luther King would be just disappointed, like, where we are. But those are some of the things that are coming up. And this is the last week, y'all, for Hold On, which is the St. Louis Black Repertory Theater's production. So if I'm going to be there this weekend. If you haven't gone, it's time for you to get your ticket. And Kalima went last week. How was it, Kalima?
Hey, it was a great production. And it really did bring back to life what went down in Selma, you know, that whole struggle for voting rights, and what the battle between King and President Lyndon Johnson in terms of, like, fighting to get that particular bill passed.
So I'm looking forward to seeing it then. If I got your approval, it must be all right. So we'll see you next week. This is Jamala Rogers signing off. I'll see you on the battlefield.
To be continued.
Yeah, bro. Okay.